all the imperialist powers are inevitably nothing more than a truce in periods between wars. Peaceful alliances prepare the ground for wars, and, in their turn, grow out of wars. The one is the condition for the other, giving rise to alternating forms of peaceful and non-peaceful struggle out of the single basis of imperialist connections and the relations between world economics and world politics. But in order to pacify the workers and to reconcile them with the social chauvinists who have deserted to the side of the bourgeoisie, Wyss-Kotsky separates one link of a single chain from the other, separates the present peaceful and ultra-imperialist, nay, ultra-ultra-imperialist, alliance of all the powers for the pacification of China. Remember the suppression of the Boxer Rebellion from the non-peaceful conflict of tomorrow, which will prepare the ground for another peaceful general alliance for the partition, say, of Turkey on the day after tomorrow, etc., etc. Instead of showing the vital connection between periods of imperialist peace and periods of imperialist war, Kotsky puts before the workers a lifeless abstraction solely in order to reconcile them to their lifeless leaders. An American writer, David Jane Hill, in his History of Diplomacy in the International Development of Europe, points out in his preface the following periods of contemporary diplomatic history. 1. The Revolutionary Period. 2. The Constitutional Movement. 3. The Present Period of Commercial Imperialism. Another writer divides the story of Great Britain's foreign policy since 1870 into four periods. 1. The First Asiatic Period, that of the struggle against Russia's advance in Central Asia towards India. 2. The African Period, approximately 1885 to 1902, that of the struggle against France for the partition of Africa, the Fashoda Incident of 1898, which brought France within a hair's breadth of a war with Great Britain. 3. The Second Asiatic Period, alliance with Japan against Russia. And 4. The European Period, chiefly anti-German. The political skirmishes of outposts take place on the financial field, wrote Reiser, the banker, in 1905, in showing how French finance capital operating in Italy was preparing the way for a political alliance between the countries, and how a conflict was developing between Great Britain and Germany over Persia, among all the European capitalists over Chinese loans, etc. Behold, the living reality of peaceful ultra-imperialist alliances in their indissoluble connection with ordinary imperialist conflicts. The toning down of the deepest contradictions of imperialism by Kotsky, which inevitably becomes an embellishment of imperialism, leaves its traces in this writer's criticism of the political features of imperialism. Imperialism is the epoch of finance capital and of monopolies, which introduce everywhere the striving for domination, not for freedom. The result is reaction all along the line, whatever the political system, and an extreme intensification of existing antagonisms in this domain also. Particularly acute becomes the yoke of national oppression and the striving for annexations, i.e., the violation of national independence, for annexation is nothing else than the violation of the right of nations to self-determination. Hilferding justly draws attention to the relation between imperialism and the growth of national oppression. In regard to the newly opened up countries themselves, he writes, the capitalism imported into them intensifies contradictions and constantly excites the growing resistance against the intruders of the peoples who are awakened to national consciousness. This resistance can easily become transformed into dangerous measures directed against foreign capital. The old social relations become completely revolutionized. The age-long agrarian incrustation of nations without a history is blasted away, and they are drawn into the capitalist whirlpool. Capitalism itself gradually procures for the vanquished the means and resources for their emancipation, and they set out to achieve the same goal which once seemed highest to the European nations, the creation of a single national state as a means to economic and cultural freedom. This movement for national independence threatens European capital in its valuable and most promising fields of exploitation, and European capital can maintain its domination to an increasing extent only by continually increasing its means of exercising violence. To this must be added that it is not only in newly opened up countries, but also in the old, that imperialism is leading to annexation, to increased national oppression, and, consequently, also to increased resistance. While opposing the intensification of political reaction caused by imperialism, Kautsky obscures the question, which has become very serious, of the impossibility of unity with the opportunists in the epoch of imperialism. While objecting to annexations, he presents his objections in a form that will be most acceptable and least offensive to the opportunists. He addresses himself to a German audience, yet he obscures the most topical and important point. For instance, the annexation by Germany of Alsace-Lorraine. In order to appraise this mental aberration, we will take the following example. Let us suppose that a Japanese is condemning the annexation of the Philippine Islands by the Americans. Will many believe that he is doing so because he has a horror of annexations as such, and not because he himself has a desire to annex the Philippines? And shall we not be constrained to admit that the fight the Japanese is waging against annexations can be regarded as sincere and politically honest only if he fights against the annexation of Korea by Japan and urges freedom for Korea to secede from Japan? Kautsky's theoretical analysis of imperialism, as well as his economic and political criticism of imperialism, is permeated through and through with a spirit absolutely incompatible with Marxism, of obscuring and glossing over the most profound contradictions of imperialism, and with a striving to preserve the crumbling unity with opportunism in the European labor movement at all costs. Chapter 10, The Place of Imperialism in History. We have seen that the economic quintessence of imperialism is monopoly capitalism. This very fact determines its place in history. For monopoly that grew up on the basis of free competition and out of free competition is the transition from the capitalist system to a higher social economic order. We must take special note of the four principal forms of monopoly, or the four principal manifestations of monopoly capitalism, which are characteristic of the period under review. 1. Monopoly arose out of the concentration of production at a very advanced stage of development. This refers to the monopolist-capitalist combines, cartels, syndicates, and trusts. We have seen the important role these play in modern economic life. At the beginning of the 20th century, monopolies acquired complete supremacy in the advanced countries. And although the first steps towards the formation of the combines were first taken by countries enjoying the protection of high tariffs, Germany, America, England, with her system of free trade, was not far behind in revealing the same phenomenon, namely, the birth of monopoly out of the concentration of production. 2. Monopolies have accelerated the capture of the most important resources of raw materials, especially for the coal and iron industry, which is the basic and most highly trustified industry in capitalist society. The monopoly of the most important sources of raw materials has enormously increased the power of big capital, and has sharpened the antagonism between trustified and non-trustified industry. 3. Monopoly has sprung from the banks. The banks have developed from modest intermediary enterprises into the monopolists of finance capital. Some 3 or 5 of the biggest banks in each of the foremost capitalist countries have achieved the personal union of industrial and bank capital, and have concentrated in their hands the power to dispose of thousands upon thousands of millions which form the greater part of the capital and revenue of entire countries. A financial oligarchy, which throws a close net of relations of dependence over all the economic and political institutions of contemporary bourgeois society without exception, such is the most striking manifestation of this monopoly. 4. Monopoly has grown out of colonial policy. To the numerous old motives of colonial policy, finance capital has added the struggle for the sources of raw materials, for the export of capital, for spheres of influence, i.e., for spheres of good business, concessions, monopolist profits, and so on. In fine, for economic territory in general. When the colonies of the European powers in Africa comprised only 1/10 of the territory, as was the case in 1876, colonial policy was able to develop by methods other than those of monopoly, by the free grabbing of territories, so to speak. But when 9/10 of Africa had been seized, approximately in 1900, when the whole world had been shared out, there was inevitably ushered in a period of colonial monopoly and, consequently, a period of intense struggle for the partition and the repartition of the world. The extent to which monopolist capital has intensified all the contradictions of capitalism is generally known. It is sufficient to mention the high cost of living and the power of the trusts. This intensification of contradictions constitutes the most powerful driving force of the transitional period of history, which began at the time of the definite victory of world finance capital. Monopolies, oligarchy, the striving for domination instead of the striving for liberty, the exploitation of an increasing number of small or weak nations by an extremely small group of the richest or most powerful nations, all of these have given birth to those distinctive features of imperialism which compel us to define it as parasitic or decaying capitalism. More and more there emerges, as one of the tendencies of imperialism, the creation of the bondholding or rentier state. The usurer state, in which the bourgeoisie lives on the proceeds of capital exports, and by clipping coupons. It would be a mistake to believe that this tendency to decay precludes the possibility of the rapid growth of capitalism. It does not. In the epoch of imperialism, certain branches of industry, certain strata of the bourgeoisie, and certain countries betray, to a greater or less degree, one or other of these tendencies. On the whole, capitalism is growing far more rapidly than before, but it is not only that this growth is becoming more and more uneven. This unevenness manifests itself also, in particular, in the decay of the countries which are richest in capital, such as England. In regard to the rapidity of Germany's economic development, Reiser, the author of the book on the Great German Banks, states, "The progress of the preceding period, 1849-70, which had not been exactly slow, stood in about the same ratio to the rapidity with which the whole of Germany's national economy and with it German banking progressed during this period, 1870-1905, as the mail coach of the Holy Roman Empire of the German nation stood to the speed of the present-day automobile, which in whizzing past, it must be said, often endangers not only innocent pedestrians in its path, but also the occupants of the car. In its turn, this finance capital, which has grown so rapidly, is not unwilling, precisely because it has grown so quickly, to pass onto a more tranquil possession of colonies, which have to be captured, and not only by peaceful methods, from richer nations. In the United States, economic development in the last decades has been even more rapid than in Germany, and for this very reason, the parasitic character of modern American capitalism has stood out with particular prominence. On the other hand, a comparison of, say, the Republican American bourgeoisie with the monarchist Japanese or German bourgeoisie shows that the most pronounced political differences become insignificant during the imperialist period, not because they are unimportant in general, but because throughout it is a case of bourgeoisie with definite traits of parasitism. The receipt of high monopoly profits by the capitalists in one of the numerous branches of industry, in one of the numerous countries, etc., makes it economically possible for them to corrupt individual sections of the working class, and sometimes a fairly considerable minority, and win them to the side of the capitalists of a given industry or nation against all the others. The intensification of antagonisms between imperialist nations for the partition of the world increases this striving. And so there is created that bond between imperialism and opportunism, which revealed itself first and most clearly in England, owing to the fact that certain features of imperialist development were observable there much sooner than in other countries. Some writers, L. Martov, for example, tried to evade the fact that there is a connection between imperialism and opportunism in the labor movement, which is particularly striking at the present time, by resorting to stereotyped, optimistic arguments, a la Kautsky and Heusmann's, like the following. The cause of the opponents of capitalism would be hopeless if it were precisely progressive capitalism that led to the increase of opportunism, or if it were precisely the best-paid workers who were inclined towards opportunism, etc. We must have no illusion regarding optimism of this kind. It is optimism in regard to opportunism. It is optimism which serves to conceal opportunism. As a matter of fact, the extraordinary rapidity and the particularly revolting character of the development of opportunism is by no means a guarantee that its victory will be durable. The rapid growth of a malignant abscess on a healthy body only causes it to burst quickly, and thus relieve the body of it. The most dangerous people of all in this aspect are those who do not wish to understand that the fight against imperialism is a sham and humbug, unless it is inseparably bound up with the fight against opportunism. From all that has been said in this book on the economic nature of imperialism, it follows that we must define it as capitalism in transition, or, more precisely, as moribund capitalism. It is very instructive in this respect to note that the bourgeois economists, in describing modern capitalism, frequently employ terms like interlocking, absence of isolation, etc. In accordance with their functions and course of development, banks are not purely private business enterprises. They are more and more outgrowing the sphere of purely private business regulations. And this very Ricer, who uttered the words just quoted, declares with all seriousness that the prophecy of the Marxists concerning socialization has not been realized. What then does this word interlocking express? It merely expresses the most striking feature of the process going on before our eyes. It shows that the observer counts the separate trees without seeing the wood. It slavishly copies the superficial, the fortuitous, the chaotic. It reveals the observer as one overwhelmed by the mass of raw material and utterly incapable of appreciating its meaning and importance. Ownership of shares and relations between owners of private property interlock in a haphazard way. But the underlying factor of this interlocking, its very base, is the changing social relations of production. When a big enterprise assumes gigantic proportions and, on the basis of exact computation of mass data, organizes according to plan the supply of primary raw materials to the extent of 2/3 or 3/4 of all that is necessary for tens of millions of people, when these raw materials are transported to the most suitable place of production, sometimes hundreds or thousands of miles away, in a systematic and organized manner, when a single center directs all the successive stages of work right up to the manufacture of numerous varieties of finished articles, when these products are distributed according to a single plan among tens of hundreds of millions of consumers, as in the case of distribution of oil in America and Germany by the American Standard Oil, then it becomes evident that we have socialization of production and not mere interlocking, that private economic relations and private property relations constitute a shell which is no longer suitable for its contents, a shell which must of necessity begin to decay if its destruction be postponed by artificial means, a shell which may continue in a state of decay for a fairly long period, particularly if the cure of the opportunist abscess is protracted, but which must be inevitably removed. The enthusiastic admirer of German imperialism, Schulz Gavernitz, exclaims, "Once the supreme management of the German banks has been entrusted to the hands of a dozen persons, their activity is even today more significant for the public good than that of the majority of the ministers of state." The interlocking of bankers, ministers, magnates of industry, and bondholders is here conveniently forgotten. If we conceive of the tendencies of development which we have noted as realized to the utmost, the money capital of the nation united in the banks themselves combined in cartels, the investment capital of the nation cast in the shape of securities, then the brilliant forecast of Saint Simon will be fulfilled. The present anarchy of production caused by the fact that economic relations are developing without uniform regulation must make way for organization in production. Production will no longer be shaped by isolated manufacturers, independent of each other and ignorant of a man's economic needs, but by a social institution, a central body of management, able to survey the large fields of social economy from a more elevated point of view, will regulate it for the benefit of the whole of society, will be able to put the means of production into suitable hands, and above all, will take care that there be constant harmony between production and consumption. Institutions already exist which have assumed as part of their task a certain organization of economic labor, the banks. The fulfillment of the forecasts of Saint Simon still lies in the future, but we are on the way to its fulfillment. Marxism, different from what Marx imagined, but different only in form. A crushing refutation of Marx, indeed. It is a retreat from Marx's precise scientific analysis to St. Simon's guesswork, the guesswork of a genius, but guesswork all the same. This has been Imperialism, the Highest Stage of Capitalism by Vladimir Lenin, narrated by Joseph Kent, copyright 2018, ABN Publishing.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.